Support for KNKX comes from WSECU, a community credit union with 21 branches and a full suite of digital services. WSECU supports 9 regional farmers markets across Washington State and invites listeners to enjoy the bounty of summer at their local market. More information at WSECU.org.
So how did you guys figure out that you both play the same obscure instrument?
I think it was when I spotted your horn in your apartment and I said, what you got there?
Yeah.
Or something to the effect of. And then you said, oh, that's my baritone. And I was like, oh, is that right? And yeah. Then it became a, I do that too.
Right.
Well, you're listening to Sound Effect on KNKX 88.5. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. I am here with my good friends Ed Ronco and Ariel Van Cleve. Mm-hmm. And we are talking about something that brings you both together as KNKX's horn section.
I play the euphonium.
And I play the baritone horn.
They're essentially the same, but it's the size of the bore. His is better for marching, mine's better for concert.
It looks like the love child of a French horn and a tuba or something.
That's pretty much what it is.
It's like a middle low voice, the kind of the same octave that a trombone would be in.
Okay. So give me your like the backstory of you and the euphonium. We'll start with you, Ariel. How did this become part of your life?
Well, my seventh grade year, my dad played euphonium. So he kind of pushed me into playing euphonium without explaining that it's a pretty useless instrument in a lot of circumstances.
Wait, why?
Orchestras don't need it. If you want to go into marching band or military band, this is the thing for you, but otherwise, no. But I went for it anyway and started playing and didn't look back. I love it.
And you had?
I was in fifth grade and had, you know, tried out for school band, and they gave me a trumpet, but I had braces, and the mouthpiece size on the trumpet, it hurt me to play, because I don't know if it was in frequency with my braces or something, but my whole mouth would just ache every time I played the trumpet. So after a few crying sessions, the director gave me an instrument with a larger mouthpiece. And then I went to college and marched in the baritone section at Michigan State University in the Spartan Marching Band. And so this has really been a huge part of my life in my early adulthood.
And how about you, Ariel? Does it figure into your, like, identity?
Yeah, like a lot. So when my dad passed away my sophomore year in college, this is the horn that got me through all of it. And I did try to stop playing a couple different times, but a lot of people around me told me not to. It really pushed me to keep doing it. So I guess, you know, holding on to this horn and remembering those times, it's an anchor to just feel steady.
Yeah.
Can I add that Ariel is a much more serious musician than I? I want you to know that when I tried out for Spartan Marching Band, I was named 18th chair out of 16.
didn't know that.
Wait, is that real?
Yeah. We marched 16 people and there were 2 alternates. And it wasn't until a guy named Rory McClintock like fell off his bike and broke his ankle that I got to march in the marching band. And then I got better.
All right. Well, I would love to hear some euphonium / baritone horn coming at us from the KNKX horn section.
All right.
Cool.
It can be hard to let go of those things that helped make us who we are. I still have my tattered middle school copy of Catcher in the Rye, My wife still lugs around a bunch of old cassette tapes. Well, Can't Let Go is our theme today on Sound Effect, from conspiracy theories to the teeth of a dead pet. Stories of the things we cling to, for better or worse. When we form our identities as adolescents, a big part of expressing who we are is how we dress, what subculture we identify with. For me, it was punk nerd. But then at some point, most of us shed that persona. Nobody wants to see 40-year-old me stomping around in combat boots. But Jillian Venters never saw the need to leave her subculture behind.
I'm kind of a romantigoth with Victorian goth tinges. I get more Victorian goth as the weather gets cooler. It is really hard to wear velvet frock coats and top hats during high summer.
Jillian may be the authority on goth etiquette. She's been writing the blog Gothic Charm School for about 2 decades, and she's written a book that promises an essential guide for goths and those who love them. Writing as Lady of the Manors, Jillian dispenses advice to a lot of younger goths, whom she calls baby bats. But these days, she's also fielding a lot of questions from people in their 30s, 40s, or even older. She gives tips on staying true to their gothic roots, even while organizing kids' playdates or working in a corporate office. So I sat down with Jillian and first asked her how she discovered her own gothiness.
According to my parents, I was always this way. I announced at a family gathering when I was about 5 that I was going to be the Wicked Witch of the West when I grew up and live in a castle with flying monkeys. And I, when I was about 8 or 9 and I read Dracula, then I announced that I was going to marry Dracula and be a vampire when I grew up. But it wasn't until I hit college where I was like, oh, there is an entire subculture of people who dress in this kind of witchy vampire style, have music that's full of bombast and darker imagery, like horror novels, like horror movies. Great. And I just, about I was 18 or 19, and I was like, yes, these are my people, and I've stayed with it ever since.
What do you think it was in you that drew you to it when you were a kid?
You know, I have always been a kid who was fascinated by ghost stories, by spooky books. My father delights in recounting the story of that when I was about maybe 7. And, you know, kids get to that stage where they're like, well, there are monsters in the closet or there are monsters under the bed. I went to the local library and checked out books on folklore and drew protective symbols in crayon on pieces of paper and put them on my closet. And Dad's like, so that's so the monsters won't get you. And I said, no, it's so it slows them down so I can like make a deal with them.
So it seems like at some point most youth-oriented subcultures like this that are around fashion or whatever, that people grow out of them, right? Usually maybe in their 20s when they start going into the working world, they
right.
get out of college, maybe they have new friends, maybe they have families or something like that. So how has that been for you?
I have always been who I am. I mean, when I was working at Microsoft, I was known as that goth girl because I was walking around in like full gothic Victorian and a top hat.
Say more about how that was for you at Microsoft.
I did get a lot of like random, oh, you know, it's not Halloween, right? Or is it a holiday in your country? Which was always the question that cracked me up. And I got that multiple times.
At Gothic Charm School, you communicate with lots and lots of people who are in or peripherally in the,
yes.
the gothic subculture. How often do you hear from older people who are kind of struggling with what it means to be goth in your, say, 30s and 40s?
I'd say like maybe 30% of my mail is from older people. I've gotten a lot of email from people who used to be goth, and now it's drawing them back in, and they have concerns about, is this age appropriate for them? Which I'm always like, I'm probably older than you, and yes, it's totally age appropriate. There's a lot of people who ask, can they still be part of the subculture if they're not interested in going to nightclubs? It's a case of just reassuring people that you don't have to fit that template of lithe, pale, wan, 20-something to be in the subculture, to be in the community.
So what are some concrete pieces of advice for elder goths in terms of how to dress, how to make yourself up, that kind of stuff?
So if you don't want to, you know, pile on pale makeup and super dark eyeliner designs all over, you don't have to. And in many cases, those things are not flattering to aging skin. So, you know, some of those looks can be left behind. And for older goths especially, be aware you're going to get a lot of comments of people who are like, oh, I was a goth in college, but I grew out of it. because there's this perception that goth is a youth subculture, which is not the case. And some of the emails I get there, people are like, well, I became a parent and I didn't know if it was appropriate for me to be part of the goth subculture and still, you know, raise kids, which with my friends who are raising children, they've not had a problem. They've, you know, they've raised their kids to be very secure and very self-confident and understand that, you know, maybe mommy and daddy look different than the other people at the PTA. And that's fine. That's just part of being an individual.
The subtitle of your book is An Essential Guide for Goths and Those Who Love Them.
Yes.
So what about those who love them, particularly parents who might be a little freaked out that their child is developing what they think of as a morbid fascination?
Right. A lot of those parents who are very confused or very unsettled by this just need to be reassured that just because their child is listening to this weird bombastic music and reading creepy books and covering, you know, their entire eye socket in black eye makeup doesn't mean they're going to turn out to be serial killers. It doesn't mean they're going to turn out to be, you know, they're never going to have a job. They're never going to be a successful person. That this is a way of expressing themselves, and that this is a subculture that has roots that stretch back hundreds of years. If you can give parents some kind of classical grounding and say this is where it came from, it doesn't mean they're bad. It doesn't mean they've turned into horrible people. It means they're exploring other parts of life. And one of the things that I find a lot of parents being reassured by is when I point out this is about finding beauty and things that resonate in unexpected or darker places. The world is a scary place. The world can be terrifying at any age, but being able to find the things that maybe unsettle other people but resonate with you is a way of controlling that fear.
So you mentioned that you really like Miss Manners, and your persona on the blog is Lady of the Manners. Like,
yes.
What is your North Star for manners and etiquette, and what is the right way to behave? I mean, how do you approach that?
I guess my North Star has always been a combination of Judith Martin, of Miss Manners, of what is the way to treat people in a polite manner? What is a way to interact with someone so you don't make them uncomfortable? And Mr. Rogers, because it was always a case of be as kind as possible. And one of the things that I have been really pushing for in the 2+ decades that I've been doing this is it is possible to be a black clad weirdo and still be kind and still be friendly and nice. And you don't have to go out of your way to be gregarious. You don't have to go out of your way to be an extrovert or be friendly. But just realize that everyone's trying just as hard as you. And also in many ways, if doing what I do in the subculture and presenting myself the way I present helps someone else figure out who they want to be or figure out that they can be weird and still have self-confidence and go forth and do what they want to do. There's a whole generation of young artists and clothing designers and things coming up who, when they start their Etsy shops, when they start their online shops, email me and say, I read your blog when I was a baby bat, when I was coming up into my teen years.
What?
A baby bat.
What's that again?
A baby bat is usually the younger generation of the goths, the kids who are finding their way, who are learning about the subculture. And a lot of these artisans are like, you got me through my teens. You helped be a beacon to say that it will get better, that I will get to grow up and do what I'm interested in.
Well, Jillian Venters, also known as the Lady of the Manners, writes the blog Gothic Charm School, and she also wrote the book by the same name, Gothic Charm School, An Essential Guide for Goths and Those Who Love Them. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
It's Sound Effect from 88.5. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today is Can't Let Go. Last year, I picked up a futuristic sci-fi book written in 1965. I kind of figured it would be like a lot of those mid-century visions of the future, heavy on the flying cars and meals and a pill and all that dated stuff. But I discovered that Dune, the novel by Frank Herbert, feels as immediate and relevant today as any contemporary sci-fi story. That book has stuck with me. And it's also stuck with a guy from Tacoma named Eric Hanberg. In fact, it's been on his mind since he was a kid when he discovered that he and Herbert share a hometown. And Eric was sort of shocked there was nothing in town honoring Herbert, a guy he thought should be a favorite son of Tacoma. But as 88.5's Will James tells us, that could be about to change.
If you go to Point Defiance in Tacoma and look east across the water, you'll see a sliver of earth jutting out into Puget Sound. This finger of land wasn't always here. I'll let Eric Hanberg explain.
A copper smelter was here in Ruston, right here on the hillside, and it had a byproduct that I believe is arsenic-based in some way. It's a poisonous byproduct.
That toxic slag spilled out to form a whole peninsula of black, glassy material.
It really did look like a moonscape. It was just unforgiving. You wouldn't want to walk through it. You'd, you know, worry about twisting your ankle or something like that.
This place is off limits to the public at the moment, but Eric happens to be an elected parks commissioner here in Tacoma, so some staff escort us out there.
We're down on the unnamed future park on the peninsula, on the breakwater.
This peninsula is not quite a moonscape anymore, but it is still kind of otherworldly. Machines roam around piles of earth and boulders. They're working to transform this place into a grassy public park by next year.
So there's people building, I've called it terraforming, that might be a little too lofty of a word, but constructing these mounds that people can lay on and look out at the water.
That toxic slag is still here, deep beneath our feet. Roger Stanton is the project administrator.
Where we're standing today is about 15 feet higher than the adjacent ground, which is about 10 feet higher than where the peninsula used to be.
For Eric, this is about more than a new park. It could be the culmination of an idea that started forming when he was a kid. If he gets his way, this park's name will stand as a monument to Frank Herbert, one of the most acclaimed science fiction writers of all time, who spent long stretches of his life in Tacoma. Herbert's claim to fame is the 1965 novel Dune. Eric first read it when he was in middle school.
I got to the end of it, and there's the little bio of Frank Herbert, and it says Frank Herbert, you know, is from Tacoma, Washington. To me, the idea that he was from Tacoma was kind of, you know, this you know, like mind-blown situation. Like, I was growing up in suburbia, and I didn't know that people came from here who did things like that.
The more you learn about Frank Herbert, the stranger it is that nothing in Tacoma, not so much as a street, is named after him. After all, Dune is one of the best-selling sci-fi books in history.
Know then that it is the year 10,191.
The novel spawned more than a dozen sequels and prequels. You may be familiar with the movie. It's by the director David Lynch, and critics deemed it to be a little much. The score is by the 80s rock band Toto. But Dune is a serious novel. Herbert said he wrote it so that even people who aren't science fiction fans could get into it and get something out of it. It's all about a planet called Arrakis, also known as Dune.
A desolate, dry planet with vast deserts.
Where there's a war between imperial houses and giant worms that swim through the sand.
Gods, what a monster.
Put your right hand in the box.
And witches.
What's in the box?
Hey.
And Sting, the rock star. He's a bad guy. And in this universe, the most precious commodity is a drug that's mined from the desert.
The spice extends life. The spice expands consciousness.
Herbert said a novel should be about more than one thing. And Dune is about a lot of things, religion and leadership, also the ravages of industry and humanity's attempts to master its environment.
Frank Herbert took the genre of science fiction and is one of those first authors to like totally build a new world just from scratch.
Eric Hanberg, in addition to being a parks commissioner, has written some sci-fi books himself. And he says Dune elevated the entire genre from pulp to something grander, something more like literature.
It's really hard to write an environmentalist literary novel. It just sounds like you're preaching at someone, but embedded in Dune in a way that Frank Herbert did, and it can really resonate with people.
And that environmental element, that's where Tacoma bleeds into Dune. When Herbert was growing up in and around Tacoma, he explored Puget Sound in a cedar rowboat. He got to know members of the Salish Native American tribes. Once he swam across the Tacoma Narrows, to him, this place was idyllic. Then, as a grown-up in the 1950s, he lived by the water in Tacoma, and he'd look across and see this towering smelter on the horizon. The same smelter that created the peninsula of toxic slag where we're standing. That image of the smelter pouring smog into the sky, it left an impression on him.
Seeing his hometown, you know, being polluted so badly inspired the environmental message of Dune.
Eric has spent the past few years on something like a publicity campaign, writing and talking about Herbert's connections to Tacoma. At first, people had no idea what he was talking about, but that's starting to change.
When Lincoln High School celebrated their 100th anniversary, he was one of their 100 graduates that they recognized as, you know, with distinction. Some local bars have done some like Frank Herbert birthday parties.
Herbert died more than 30 years ago. Today, planes and valleys on one of Saturn's moons are named after planets from his universe. And soon, 11 acres in Tacoma could be named after him too. Commissioners on Tacoma's Metro Parks Board will ultimately choose the name out of suggestions made by the public. There are any number of ways they could honor Herbert, but Eric has strong feelings about the right way to do it.
In my mind, I really want to see it be Frank Herbert Park, because it's more than just the story of Dune. It's more than just naming it, you know, Arrakis Park or something like that. Like, it is about Frank Herbert. It is about his connection to Tacoma. It's about the environmentalism of him as well. It's not just Dune. It's much bigger. It's about the person.
This year, Metro Park staff asked residents to help name the new park. Out of about 500 recommendations, 300 were related to Frank Herbert and Dune.
That story from 88.5's Will James. Since we first aired that story last year, the city has given the green light to officially rename the park Dune Peninsula at Point Defiance Park. The 11-acre park will feature the Frank Herbert Trail. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. Today we've been telling stories about not letting go of something. Maybe it's an idea or a way of life that other people find a little odd. In our final story, we meet a woman who treks into the wilderness to say goodbye one last time to her beloved dog. But she's not letting go completely. She's making this journey to bring back a reminder of him that she can hold on to forever. Sound Effect contributor Joel Shupak has the story.
2.5 years ago, I buried my beloved dog, Coltrane, in a little cave along the White River, and I haven't been back. I have had a thought to go and collect some of his teeth.
Why on earth would you want to do that?
Magic.
This is my friend Leela. We're driving on Highway 216 in Central Oregon, winding through deep forests of ponderosa pine. Leela methodically works her brown hair into a thick braid and drapes it over one shoulder. She believes in the magic of things, in the aliveness of objects. I wish I could too, but I don't.
The tooth of a black dog is protection of some kind. Maybe it's a strange thing, but this is something my ancestors believed in. The world has seemed really crazy. I don't like using that word. The world has seemed more uncertain. There's so many people that I wish that I could protect.
For the last several months, Leela has suffered a mysterious back pain, so I drive her truck, and she directs me. She could use any magic that's left in this world.
So who is this dog?
I adopted him from the pound in Livingston, Montana when I was a teenager. And I was living up there in this sort of punk cabin eating roadkill, and I just saw this puppy. It was just like total connection. And so I just adopted him and brought him back. I had him for 12 years. I feel like it's possible animals could have found him and worked all of his pieces back into the land completely. But I'm hoping that we'll find his like little doggy skeleton out there.
Would you be okay if with whatever we found?
I don't know.
As we head east from the Cascade Mountains, the forest thins out into a dry, empty grassland. We turn onto a rutted gravel road and drop into a canyon full of oaks, willow, and alder. We cross the White River. We are far from home, in an enchanted wilderness. We see no one else.
Okay, here we go.
2 years ago, Leela carried the limp body of her 60-pound dog 100 yards up the rocky edge of a cliff in the dead of winter. But now she struggles to make it up the hill, leaning hard on a wooden cane, having to stop and rest every few minutes.
Oh, okay.
The doctors can't say what's wrong with her.
Good job, buddy.
She says she wants to find her dog's teeth to protect the people in her life. But I'm hoping they can do something else for her.
Look, this is a biscuit root.
She knows every flower and tree on this land.
You dig up the root and you peel off this outer skin and they just taste like bread. Straight up.
We carry on, over boulders, pushing aside oak branches, following what doesn't seem to be a path, exactly.
Do you know where we're going?
No. Is that okay?
Do you have a sense of where we're going?
It seems that we're lost. The cave, Leela says, is on one of the rocky outcroppings that line a steep cliff down to the White River.
I think it must be just on the other side of the cliff.
To me, every outcropping looks the same, but we keep looking.
Could it be lower?
No.
It doesn't seem like it.
What if we don't find it? No magic, then.
I'm beginning to lose hope that there's anything for us to find here. No magic teeth to protect Leela from her pain. But then I scramble down a steep slope of loose rock, across a stone shelf, and...
Oh my god. Leela!
Yeah?
It's here!
Inside a tiny rectangular cave is the perfect skeleton of Coltrane. A patch of dark fur is still matted to the skull. The remains of one paw are draped over the rest of the bones.
Here he is. Hey, buddy. Aww. He died really fast. He had this wound that never healed on his paw. And when I took him in, they biopsied it, and it was cancer. And I guess it had already spread.
And guess what?
What?
I see a lot of dog teeth.
Yeah, there's some dog teeth in here.
Leela pries two teeth loose with careful hands.
Nice teeth, Coltrane. The really weird thing is that Coltrane and my dad had cancer at the same time, skin cancer at the same time. And one of the things I thought about of why dog teeth were protection is that a lot of people from traditional culture hold the belief that like your animals hold a part of your soul and that they can take things that would otherwise come to us, you know? I mean, they were saying my dad had just like a few percent chance of surviving. And like, he's totally fine. So I don't know.
Before we leave, she stacks up a wall of stones to cover the entrance to Coltrane's cave, humming to herself. We walk back to the truck. Leela clutches the teeth of a black dog in one hand, her cane in the other. I have no doubt she found the magic she was looking for. I just hope she keeps some of it for herself.
That story from contributor Joel Shupak. Joel is now working on the podcast Israel Story. Okay, time to let go, guys. Our show is produced by Kevin Kniestad and Jennifer Wing with Bethany Denton. We got help this week from Shane Mailing, Will James, and Joel Shupak. Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer. Wherever you get your podcasts, we're probably there. Subscribe, rate, and review. You can write to soundeffect@knkx.org or search Facebook for KNKX Sound Effect. And be sure to tune in next week when our theme is In Traffic. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KNKX.